alive, let's hit the dance floor. Don't work too hard, my break a backbone. Return of the Mac, the king is back though. Corvette and cash, I never lack those. Shimmy, shimmy, y'all got the semi-four way. Don't step out the line like this a probate. You hit the line and tried to locate. This for the time, got time for no day.
Welcome to another edition of the Kronos Podcast, sponsored by OPW Commercial Services. I'm joined by a friend of the program and the very first ever guest on the Kronos Podcast, Kevin Hartley, co-founder and trademark attorney with Trust Tree. Kev, thanks for coming back.
Great to be back.
Excited to have you in studio. Love to talk branding with you. Trademarks go hand in hand with it. And a really unique, interesting development with the Pac-12 coming back into the fold. They got their official, they got their eighth member, and they're back into the mix. And I thought it was a perfect opportunity to talk about the power of a brand, how you resuscitate a brand, the length and lifespan of a brand, and things like that. When does a brand no longer become a brand? A lot of people talk about the ship of Theseus kind of thing, where you take off a bunch of different parts of it. As a Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast fan, it's obviously crucial to us as Sixers fans, but it still has the perception. So just talk a little bit about how you view the Pac-12 coming back in a completely different form.
Totally. Well, I'll bring it straight to trademarks. What makes a trademark is that it's a source identifier. What does that mean? It means that a consumer uses it to identify a source of goods or services. So when you hear Pac-10, or even maybe Pac-12, or maybe Pac-8, they have trademark registrations actually for all of those things. Because when a consumer hears that, when me or you or a sports fan hears Pac-10, you still think of something. You think of maybe traditional teams, or you think of logos, or you think of late night college football. You know, I think of the old Reggie Bush, Matt Leinart, Pete Carroll USC teams, and how much I used to love watching those late night Pac-10 games, or after that, you know, watching the Oregon Ducks and everything that they were doing as they went from sort of a, you know, non-existent player to a powerhouse in college football. All of those things are part of what makes the Pac-12 or the Pac-10 a trademark, because we have a relationship with them. When we hear that, we think of certain things that relate to it. So a trademark will continue to exist so long as that exists and so long as the trademark is in use. Once a trademark goes out of use, it can be abandoned. Typically, it takes 3 years of non-use for there to be a presumption that a trademark's been abandoned. You know, when you look at something like the Pac-10 or Pac-12, sure, they've struggled in recent years with conference realignment. And really, it goes back to media deals. They were slow to make media deals. If you really want to track the trajectory of the big conferences, you can look back to the college football media deals. You can start with the SEC's rise, really looking back to the early 90s when they signed their deal with CBS for, I think it was like $17 million, $20 million a year back then. And nobody else had a deal like that. And fast forward, all of these conferences start signing new big deals in the early 2000s. And now, of course, we have these monster media rights deals. Well, the Pac-10, Pac-12, they were slow on the uptake to realize this was the future. And that, I think, was the beginning of what led to where we're at now, which is that brand losing value. But it didn't cease to exist. And in fact, they realize there's value. If there weren't value, they wouldn't be trying so hard to maintain it, right? By doing what we've seen them do in the past few days, cobbling this back together, making this invite to Texas State so that they now have enough teams to hopefully go negotiate a new media deal. So that trademark still exists, still has value. I look at any number of recent reorganizations or restructures of businesses we all know. For example, Bed Bath & Beyond had a big bankruptcy. Most of us, if you live out in the suburbs, certainly you've probably driven by a closed Bed Bath & Beyond in recent months because they've closed all of their locations. But when they filed that bankruptcy, Rakuten paid $30 million for their trademark portfolio because of the brand recognition. The brand continues to exist so long as it exists in consumers' minds.
Right.
So for the Pac-10, Pac-12, or whatever the new version is going to be, because along with this announcement, there's been an announcement that there will be some rebranding. There's talk of changing the name to the Pan American Conference. There's talk of dropping the number altogether, so it's just the PAC or the PAC. And we've seen this. We've seen, you know, the Big 12 become the, you know, B1G, or how they've evolved their branding. And so it's not surprising to me to see that there's somebody out there saying, hey, this still has something. We shouldn't let this go. We may come to regret that if we try to establish something without holding on to this historical brand that people have a relationship with.
Yeah. You just mentioned the Big Ten made me think about how you think about when you're setting up an organization or company or whatever. You think farther into the future about how it's going to evolve. And we talk about the numbers on the conference names. It's obviously limiting, right? SEC didn't have to worry about that because Southeastern Conference, there's no numbers. Nothing that's going to change is going to really make any difference on that, other than maybe as they get out of the Southeast with bringing in a Texas and Oklahoma, but still people call it SEC.
Right.
So how do you look at, like, for business owners, leaders, whoever we're talking about, it's really hard to think 20, 30 years into the future, mm-hmm. when things are going to look completely different. How would you look at these conferences, whether you're advising a Pac-12, for instance, on, we know that we're different, we want to keep the same kind of draw that we had, but we have to tweak it a little bit. So, like, how do you view those changes? How far do you go?
Rebrands are difficult. And we can stay in the area of sports to look at that. You know, there are so many teams, organizations, or, you know, you can look even all the way from NCAA to the conferences to the universities themselves. And we were just talking before coming on here about some of the rebranding in professional sports, the successes, the failures. You know, I'm a Titans fan, but we love the Oilers jerseys. We love the Oilers logos. I think we prefer those to the Titans color scheme and logos, most Titans fans would say. But we don't have that same relationship that the city of Houston may have had to oil or the Oilers or this idea. So, of course, the decision was made to do that rebrand. But whether it was ultimately successful or not, I think remains in the eye of the beholder. The most successful rebrands, in my opinion, have to do with personality. I describe trademarks like your signature, but your brand like your personality, right? So if you want to have a successful rebrand and you're the Pac-12, well, number one, you look at something like calling it the Pac-12 to begin with. This fits with something that we've, I think, touched on before. I'll point to my law firm as an example, though. The law firm's legal name is Trust Tree Legal, right? But we do business as Trust Tree. Legal is a generic term, and it's got no value. You could start Kronos Legal tomorrow, and I couldn't say, oh, well, Kronos Legal, I'm Trust Tree Legal, you're infringing my trademark, because that's just a generic term. So when you add in generic elements, oftentimes, I find that they can be distracting from your actual brand. So I would immediately say, well, drop the number if you don't know that that's going to be the number, or if it doesn't have some other meaningful significance, right? And then beyond that, I'd say, so what is the personality of your brand? When people think of the pack, what do you want them to think of? How do you want them to feel, right? I say, make a list of those words, things you want people to feel or things that relate to those feelings. And then let's look at, okay, how do we incorporate this into our brand strategy, right? Maybe it's you want people to think of the West Coast. And I think of the traditional, I think I'm remembering this correctly, one of the Pac-12 10 logos had like a wave, right, incorporated into it. That, to me, is the way to approach. What do we want people to think about when they think of this? If we want the personality of it to be West Coast beachy vibes, yeah, we need that. But this new version, as we know, is going to have teams from places that aren't, I think, traditionally thought of as West Coast.
Yeah.
Right? So you're going to need something different that communicates something different. And that's a larger strategy than just, what's your trademark, right? The trademark is the signature. The branding is going to be all those other things they do. When you go to the website for the conference, when you see a commercial for the conference, when you see the choices they ultimately make when it comes to the way they want all of these teams to sort of also behave as members of the conference. I think about the SEC and the SEC. There's a culture to the SEC. I went to the University of Tennessee, and everybody back when I went already would be chanting SEC at games where UT was not playing, where our bitter rival might be playing if they were playing a team from another conference, right? There's something cultural to it, or at least people in the South certainly feel that way. And so as the SEC's gone about expansion, adding teams like Oklahoma and Texas, it felt culturally like they would fit. There's been that element, and I think that's what's made it successful. I think the same is true for the Big Ten. There was some thought of what is sort of like the identity of Big Ten sports, Big Ten football, a Big Ten school, and the schools that have joined fit that identity. I think the conferences that have struggled with realignment, sometimes it's where that identity doesn't fit. And to me, that comes back to the branding, because it's, does this school fit the personality that we want this conference to portray? And you know about this with SMU.
Yeah.
I think SMU is a great example of a school with deep, deep history when it comes to football. And so what a brilliant thing, really, ultimately, for the ACC and SMU, despite the haters, to go forward the way they did and look at the results, right?
Well, you know,
already there and bringing the profile of the conference up. And that's what the new Pac-10, Pac-12, whatever they call it, that's what it's going to need to really succeed.
Keeping that alignment and values, ACC did that. There's obviously geographically doesn't make sense at all, but the three schools they added fit the exact profile, you know, generally higher academic standards, enough history, things like that. I think the Pac is going about it I think they're thinking about it the right way, and that it's more up-and-coming schools, you know, that have some resources but are dynamic and nimble, which is cool. And I think that's a good identity to have, as, hey, we're not traditional powers, but we're, you know, we've had a lot of success. We've just needed, you know, that seat at the table, proverbially. You mentioned something going back that I think is especially relevant to businesses, which is you can wind up in that death spiral where it's, we have this history, we have this trademark. Well, you know, this is the perception, but that's no longer really who you are. And then you wind up almost holding on to that too long and trying to be what you weren't. And you wind up with a negative customer interaction. So for those people that are, you know, they've got that warm and fuzzy about the history of the Pac-10, but then they go to turn on a Pac-10 game and they're being told this is the same thing, or it's being presented, hey, we're back. And then they go and turn on the TV and like, I don't even know who these two schools are. How do you, you know, how would you advise people that are in that situation where you've got this history, you are fundamentally different now, but you have this and you feel like you need to hang on to it?
It's a great question. And getting back to what drives a rebrand to begin with, so many businesses that have been, you know, the sort of businesses you think could never fail. I think of Sears. Sears, just a hegemonic business. The Sears Tower, you know, for goodness sake, this iconic building that bears this name. There was a Sears in every town. Sears ceases to exist at this point, for the most part. You know, that brand still exists. Somebody at some point probably will try to inject new life in it. But injecting new life into a brand is hard.
Yeah.
For the exact reason you're talking about. It's like nobody wants to be told that something is one thing when it clearly is not that thing. You don't want to be told, oh, come back. Remember Pac-12 football you always loved? High scoring national championship teams. Great tradition, right? Well, great tradition is still true, but maybe it's not the same championship level competition right now. So you've got to find a way to sell people on what it is. And you've got to have, I think, a clear vision of what that story is you're going to tell. Because people love narrative. Three-act story structure exists for a reason. people can follow it. We are used to it. And I think most businesses could benefit from looking at their narrative. So when we were talking about those long-term decisions, you should always be thinking about, what is your story? What is the story of the Pac-12? And people, from my experience, want to be leveled with. They know that there's been change. They know it's not the same. So either owning that or telling a new story is more likely to appeal to people. Because if you are holding on to that old story, you'll end up like Sears. You'll end up like so many of these brands that, because they had so much recognition, were so well known, were so successful, they say, well, we can't tell a different story. We can't change our story. And the brands that do, the brands that find ways to evolve, are the brands that tend to thrive. And we are seeing that once again with how this is going with conference realignment. The narrative was there for the SEC, for the Big Ten, for the ACC. And it's just going to take them figuring that out, but then also committing to it. I think what's happened with several of the conferences as this has unfolded is they haven't known what their identity is. They haven't had a good feel for what they want that identity even to be, because what's happened is they've been reacting.
Right.
Right. And so I think the bigger lesson is you need to be proactive. You always need to be proactive. One of the people in the studio when I came in here today, we were just making small talk, and I was talking about the amazing space in this incredible studio, and also about virtual work, because they mentioned that a lot of people were working virtually today. And I said, oh, well, you know, when we founded our law firm back in 2014, we founded it with the intent on being virtual from day one. And I used to go to conferences and talk about virtual business. And a few times kind of got laughed out of the room. One time in Austin in November 2019, I was talking to a bunch of lawyers about incorporating more virtual elements into their practice. Of course, I had no idea a pandemic was coming.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a reason I was talking about it. But a few months later, all of these people started calling me wanting to know more about virtual practice. But we came by it honestly and very authentically, because that was our plan from the beginning. So we've never had clients caught off guard by there being so few people in the office or by proposing any sort of virtual deposition, perhaps, or mediation, or something that traditionally is done in person, because that's the identity we committed to from day one. And it served us well as things changed. We didn't know things would change this fast. We just felt like, well, 20 years from now, increasingly, people are going to want virtual services, including virtual legal services, right? So you need to be looking to what you think the future is. I think that the best businesses always are doing that. The hard part is deciding how far to go and committing, right? Because the Pac-10 could have said years ago, when all these people left, we're going to pause for a minute rather than just bringing in whatever teams we can so that we can survive. We're going to take a step back and say, what is our identity going forward? And how do we want people to perceive us going forward? What's the story we're going to tell people about who we were and who we're becoming, right? Just like there's a story I love to tell about my old traditional billable hour law firm where I put on a suit every day and went into a nice office in downtown Nashville versus who I am now, which is an attorney that mostly works from home in a virtual law firm, right? But there is something narratively satisfying about that story when I break down the reasons why that for many of our clients will resonate. Some people will say, oh, well, I want that other type of lawyer still. But those aren't the clients I'm after.
Right.
Right. Those aren't the clients I'm interested in. So I think for, you know, the PAC, well, who are their consumers? Who are their customers? Right. I'm sure it's probably more to do with sports fans than anything right now, because I do believe you need a media rights deal in this day and age to survive and to thrive as a conference. And so I think their goals are probably being driven toward that and getting that done. So how are you going to appeal to a new group of fans, though, who aren't going to care about your history, who aren't going to care that you used to be a lawyer who put on a suit and went into a nice big office building downtown every day, and now, you know, this is about as dressed up as I get day to day, right? How am I going to show them, well, I am still the same lawyer, but maybe I'm a better fit for your business now? Just like, hey, well, we are still, you know, the Pack, and because we are the Pack, we have all of this history, but now we're this version, and here's the product we offer, right? Which is these sorts of up and coming schools from around the country that have some history that we think are going to have a lot of fans in the future.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned thinking and telling the story and how you deliver your message and deliver what you want to be. I remember that basically what caused the demise really of the previous iteration after a couple of those schools left was they were left with a streaming deal. It was basically a streaming only deal. And then the presidents didn't go for it and it all collapsed. I'll never forget. They were going to announce the media rights deal, and then SMU was going to get the invitation into the Pack. And then it became this streaming only deal. I think back on that now that there actually would have been a really compelling narrative to tell about that, that, hey, generally, you know, Pac-12, whatever you want to call it, West Coast, more progressive, the vanguard, Silicon Valley, tech-centered, we're going to be the conference that owns the streaming deal. And we're going to be the ones that the younger generation is going to look to. You're not going to be the boomer that still has cable and is dealing with DirecTV that's doing the CBS that's old. We're going to be the new, we're going to be the streaming only. And that could have been a really, really cool narrative to have and to grow that way and almost say, you know, hey, okay, you know, USC leaves, whatever. Those are old school teams. Like, that's not us anymore. We're the new wave, right? To use a little bit of the West Coast terminology. But
I think that's brilliant. I just have to say that's exactly what I'm talking about.
But how do you do that in this situation? You've got, you know, a conference commissioner is not necessarily a marketing specialist.
Right. Even if he was a marketing specialist, that's a hard decision to make. When my partners and I started our firm back in 2014, we put together a giant business plan. We pitched it to our old firm saying, let us do this new model. Help us. We want to provide these online commoditized legal services at a low flat rate. That's what we want to do. We think we can leverage technology to do that. These coming technologies, and we can be the future of legal services. And I understand why ultimately our firm didn't do it, because it was new and it was different and it seemed maybe extreme to some people there, right? So it can be very hard, even where plenty of people at the firm also were like, oh, we think this is a great idea. Mm. We think this is what's going to be happening increasingly, and we think that you should do this. But getting the whole firm aligned to support us was difficult, right? So when you think about an organization as big as the Pac-12 and such a risky proposition, right? Even if you were right, even if that commissioner had signed that deal and been right, that commissioner probably doesn't survive long enough for us to get to the point where streaming has now maybe gotten to where, had you just been doing streaming deals, you might be able to get the biggest and best deal, because Amazon or Netflix, you're already there, you're already streaming, and it just makes sense to house your channel as, you know, a clickable space within their platform. But I think about Major League Baseball, honestly, when you talk about this, because as maybe somebody's discussed on this podcast before, I'm sure some of your listeners know, Major League Baseball really set itself up for a lot of success by building its own streaming platform and technology years and years ago, that now I think even HBO or Max, you know, speaking of rebrands, that's a rebrand I could go on and on about, the sort of fumbling of the HBO brand equity trying to roll out this other thing. And now they're going back
because they realize where we started.
they realize HBO is the hook. That is our most valuable trademark, our most valuable brand. But I digress. The point is, Major League Baseball built streaming technology that allowed it to have a competitive advantage over not just other professional sports leagues, but in the new media landscape where that technology has been licensed and used by any number of other parties who are providing streaming services, right? So there are these other things if you're going to change your business model, for example, by doing your own streaming, right? And maybe you miss out on media deals and you do a streaming only deal, but you look back and who knows what the missed opportunities were, because maybe whomever the Pac-12 engages to help build that streaming platform, technology that will then be owned by them, all of a sudden the SEC saying, hey, we need to license that. We want that, right? Just to say, there's so much opportunity that you will miss out on sometimes when you don't take those chances on those new things. I think taking the chance on doing the new thing is really hard, but it's not if you already are at a competitive disadvantage. I just feel like as an SEC fan, I remember as everything was happening, all I thought was like, why are they trying to compete with us right now? You know, the SEC just so clearly has such a fervent giant fan base that both advertisers and media partners see so much value in, that they're going to back up the Brinks truck and pay whatever it takes. But if you don't have that, then you need to do something different. Why are you trying to do what the SEC is doing or the Big Ten is doing? Right. And I think the ACC did a good job with that. The Big 12, those brands, those conferences, they weren't the Big Ten and the SEC, which maybe feel like the real winners here overall. But I wouldn't say that, because if you look at the financials, too, the ACC, the Big 12, they're thriving.
Yeah,
they're thriving. And they've got opportunity to negotiate some really big deals in the future if they can continue to nurture these brands the way they have.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple that it's easy to, you know, to punch on the ones that don't work out or the dying brands, the brands that were great. You mentioned Sears, Kodak always comes up, obviously, is giant players that kind of rested on their laurels and then wind up essentially as nothing. I think the proactive rebrands are really interesting to talk about, because a lot of times I don't think people really even realize it's going on. The most successful ones where it's, you know, hey, things are going well, but we've got to reposition ourselves, or we've got to update our messaging, or whatever it may be.
Sure.
Versus a Jaguar, for instance, that they have a big rebrand strategy that gets a lot of attention and it's a total flop,
right?
And sales essentially almost go to zero. So it's almost like they're secret agents a little bit in the way they do it. Is that what it is, that hey, it's these subtle rebrands where it's a little tweak here, a little tweak there, to where people don't necessarily realize in one, you're not delivering a fully new package to people, but all of a sudden it's, you know, 5 years in and we now associate, whether it's better packaging or like those little tweaks. Is there anything there with, hey, a subtle, you know, almost over time rebrand is a better strategy than a here's our new look kind of deal? Or am I completely off on that?
No, I don't think you're off at all. I think you're spot on for the most part. Now, sometimes, even if you're trying to do those things, even if you're trying to keep up with the times, keep your brand fresh, you may realize one day that you failed to do that. And maybe you feel you need something bigger. But if you really think about the most successful brands, Apple, Nike, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, maybe setting Nike aside because Just Do It has persisted the whole time. But you look at all of them, their logos have slightly changed. Their slogans have changed. Their commercials have changed. They are changing. They are evolving. But they're always generally trying to keep that core thing that people always will have the attachments to, like the swoosh mark, or with Apple, the Apple insignia. But, you know, they tweak them. They change them. Reebok, I wrote a lot about. I used to have a blog, and when, you know, blogging was all the rage, I know you dabbled in a few blogs yourself.
Absolutely.
And I had a whole series about Reebok rebranding years ago, trying to move more toward being a fitness brand, focus on CrossFit, and they changed their logo. And it was probably more of a flop than a success, but that probably had more to do with Reebok's place in the market already, right? They weren't number two when they rebranded. It wasn't Nike Reebok. It was like Adidas has passed us, New Balance has passed us. Ultimately, they went for a refresh once it was clear the writing was on the wall and they were failing. So back to your point, had they tried to do some of that rebranding sooner, right, when they roll out, you know, back when like Iverson is signed to the brand or whomever, that's a time to roll it out.
Yeah.
Like you've got one of the, you know, new faces of the league. You want to roll out a little bit of a rebrand? My opinion, do it then. Mm-hmm. Do it at the top. It doesn't need to be a big overhaul then, but instead they wait and wait and wait and wait and lose market share and lose market share and lose market share, and then say, now we're going to do a whole big thing. This is the new, you know, the new version. We're the new Reebok.
Yeah.
But by then you've lost people.
Yeah. I think now I want to talk a little bit about Nike, because that's an interesting difference with Nike is a lot of times when it's brand, it's keep brand front and center, front and center, front and center. You know, everything needs to be about the brand. But then you look at Nike and obviously with Jordan, mm-hmm. you know, that's a once in a generation type of talent, but you get the Jordan brand and then they continue to invest in Jordan brand as, you know, basically without the swoosh behind it.
Yeah.
And then you've got Kobe as well and his line of shoes. And they've done an interesting job of continuing to keep the perception of the swoosh pretty sacred.
Right.
I think if you ask anybody, any athlete, any fan, and you just say, hey, do we want our school to be Nike or Adidas mm-hmm. or Under Armour? They'll all say Nike. And so they've kept that cool, but they've really invested a lot in those sub-brands, which I think is a lot different than what you normally see from a, you know, an apparel brand to have, where usually it's just, hey, we want the one brand and everything flies that flag. They went a different route and they've continued to invest in that. Now, they've had their struggles for a lot of different reasons, but more strategy based than retail versus online. But talk about them and how they were able to successfully position, you know, basically a different brand under the same umbrella, but position that in a really strong way while maintaining their own brand as well.
When you have these transcendent athletes, you've got an opportunity to do that, but you can also really lose something too in doing that. You know, they had the Tiger brand and then Tiger has now left Nike. And a lot of investment went into that brand. And that brand, I'm sure, will continue to exist. They've registered a bunch of trademarks. We'll see what they do with them. The transcendent athlete, I think, is what allowed Nike to do that. Because increasingly, as we get further and further away from the time Jordan played and young people really having the same relationship with Jordan, increasingly you hear talk of, well, is this person going to sign as a Jordan brand athlete, this NBA player, this high schooler or college kid, or are they going to be a Nike athlete? And they're running themselves into some of those questions. You have to be very, very careful with your brand strategy when you do that. You have to make sure you know, well, what is the difference between the Jordan brand and the Nike brand? Because there needs to be something. There needs to be something about the type of athlete we sign, or the type of commercial we run, right? It leads me to something I talk to my clients about a lot, which is, I think there are really two kind of strategies you can adopt when it comes to how you manage your trademarks, especially if you have multiple products or multiple services you offer and you're considering, how do we brand these? Do we brand everything independently? Do we have one big overarching brand? And so those really are the two strategies. It's does everything have its own trademarks? Does everything have its own slogans? Or do we commit to one sort of core house brand, house identity? And let me just give you some examples to make this more concrete. I point to Apple sometimes as a company that was doing one thing and has sort of pivoted to doing the other. And it makes a lot of sense why they probably decided to do what they did. So take Apple. Growing up, you remember the iMac, you know, all sorts of different Macintosh iterations.
All the colors.
All the colors. Then we had, of course, the iPod, the iPhone, iTunes, this thing that just took over branding in the culture in this way where people were putting I or E in front of all these things. And then what happened? They announced the Apple Watch. Well, they didn't announce it. Everyone knew they were working on a watch. Well, some people who thought they were being really smart went and filed trademark applications to register iWatch, among other things. And I'm not saying it's because people were trying to register iWatch. I think Apple realized, we're Apple. We're maybe the most well-known brand in the world, or certainly one of them at this point. Why give every product its own name when we can just double down on the brand? So for a long time now, think about it. Apple Watch, Apple TV, Apple Music. You take your core, your strong trademark, and then you just call the product whatever the product's called. As I told you earlier, Trust Tree Legal, you don't have trademark rights in the word legal, right? Just like you can't have trademark rights in the word music if it relates to music. Apple Music really is brilliant. Why call it iMusic? Why call it anything else where you have to then spend time familiarizing people with that brand? Instead, you put Apple, and people who love Apple, they're going to be interested in that Apple product, right? You don't need to give it a new name. You don't need to build a whole strategy around that new name. I'm of the mind that eventually we're more likely to see Nike do less of that. I think that those were aberrations.
Yeah.
And there's probably a reason you haven't seen them really do it again. I also think athletes aren't going to be inclined to do that, right? I think an athlete's going to say, let's just pick one, Arch Manning. If Nike eventually came to him and said, hey, Arch, we're going to do an Arch line, there's a world in which that might dilute his own brand, because he may say, well, I want to work with one company for maybe a shoe line, but then I want to work with another company for this performance athletic gear line. And I don't want it to have to be Nike. I don't want to be wedded to that. It comes down to a lot of things, how these brands ultimately decide when to roll out a new sort of sub-brand or not. And somebody like Nike, if it's Jordan, if it's Kobe, I think it makes a lot of sense. And in real time, it made a ton of sense.
Yeah.
Again, it'll be interesting to see 50 years from now.
Sure.
What do those brands mean to people? Do they mean the same things? If they do, it's going to probably be because Nike's invested in ensuring that they continue to.
Yeah.
But the more and more those brands and those people who made those brands popular maybe recede from the forefront of our consciousness, I wouldn't be surprised to see Nike steer away and increasingly into the Nike brand.
Yeah. Last thing, we like to do a little Mount Rushmore, and you know, obviously our history is anytime we can rank something, we want to rank something, but give us, and I didn't prep you for this, but I know it's always in your mind, but a little Mount Rushmore of companies right now that are just crushing it branding wise. Like for your Mount Rushmore for, hey, this would be, if I was teaching a business school course, these are the companies that I would tell everybody to study.
Let me just start with a story that I think is worth some attention, which is the Stanley Cup brand.
Yeah, sure.
I love stories like this, right? A brand that's out there that's existed for some time. This isn't a new brand. People may think it's new, but they have a product, and it's a product that's popular among maybe more blue collar sort of people. And realizing the opportunity to put out some different colors, gear your brand toward household use, everyday use for every person, not limiting your market, and all of the sudden there's an explosion, right? An explosion in popularity. That, to me, shows there was somebody there in marketing or somewhere who, if they didn't get a raise or if they didn't get a promotion, they deserved one because they realized we're limiting ourselves maybe to one market where we could be really popular if we broadened our horizons to more markets. As far as brands that are killing it, boy, you know, Netflix.
Yeah.
I think Netflix has done an amazing job. About a decade ago, Netflix announced a rebrand. They were going to have two brands. I believe it was Netflix and maybe it was Quickster. It was something like that. The Quickster brand was going to be for anybody who still wanted to have DVDs mailed to them and would have a lower price point. And then the Netflix was going to be brand was going to be streaming only. And then there'd be a tier, of course, where you could still get both. And there was a giant backlash. Gigantic. And they ultimately didn't move forward with it. By the way, sometimes you get it right by not doing that.
Yeah.
By actually listening.
Yeah.
When people are like, we don't like this. We don't get it. It's confusing. Getting back to how do you manage the multiple brands? It was also going to start chipping away at all this equity that Netflix had built up in the Netflix brand. Look at HBO and look at HBO Max and Max, Warner Discovery, this whole thing. Right. Who knows what it is and what happened there. So Netflix is more the example of, okay, maybe we should listen. I remember when HBO Max rolled out and then Max, and people were being critical of this, saying, HBO, just keep it HBO. And I think David Zaslav may look back and say, maybe we would have been better off doing that, right? Clearly, they're going back for a reason. Netflix, on the other hand, never went forward just because they said they were going to go forward. They stopped before it was too late, and they stay winning.
And Netflix was struggling. There was a period of time for a couple of years where stock was down pretty significantly. They were struggling. They weren't growing.
They hadn't made any revenue yet.
Yeah.
They weren't. They made revenue. They weren't cash flow positive. They weren't even close. They weren't profitable. People kept saying, well, when's it going to come? When's it going to come? We don't care how many active users you have. At some point, you have to make money.
Yeah.
And so you're right. They were. And to be in, and it was that time. It was sort of that moment of, this has to level up.
Yep.
And to still have the guts to rethink your strategy. And ever since then, you know, Netflix is TV.
They're destroying everybody that isn't YouTube.
That isn't YouTube. And so I would also say YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, I really look at both of those as sort of, it's the two of them and everybody else. And that's now TV, right? My kids, to them, TV's not TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be Netflix. It's going to be YouTube.
Well, they've stayed with what their identity
is. They've stayed with what their identity is, and they've always had such a grit. They understood maybe earlier than anybody that the future was, for lack of a better word, influencers.
Yeah.
Right? Influencer had such a negative connotation, I feel like, for so long. And increasingly, at least in the United States, I think, being an influencer, having your little micro business is going to be a huge section of the economy. It's already proven to be, but YouTube really was early in rewarding those people,
right,
and giving them a platform and in helping them raise their platform if they were getting clicks and they were getting views. And I've got one of my best clients is a person who, you know, she had a lot of success as Miss Kentucky and then was on The Amazing Race, but she sort of really built her profile vlogging on YouTube starting a decade plus ago, right? And committed to it and started to build an audience. And she built an audience. YouTube enabled her to grow and transcend the platform, right? So I do think that, yeah, YouTube's done a great job always knowing its identity, sticking to it, and evolving it, right? And that's what so many of the best brands do. So I'll point to those two for sure. I grew up in the hospitality industry, as you know. My dad was in my dad was in the hotel business. Then my mom and dad were in the restaurant business after that. And I really am fascinated with brand strategy when it comes to hospitality. My dad was with Holiday Inn for years. Holiday Inn famously had an awful rebrand, cost them over $1 billion at the time when we didn't throw the word billion around the way I think we do today.
Yep.
And that wasn't a very good one. And I'm really interested in the future of hospitality branding, because for a long time, I have felt that we have too many sub-brands now.
Yep.
And I'm a Hilton loyalist because my dad ultimately ended up working for Hilton for over 30 years. And I love Hiltons and I love Hilton properties. But I think that if there were a few fewer concepts, it would serve them well. And I do think we're seeing now some of the big brands that never started rolling out a lot of other sub-brands to kind of meet different categories or price points or types of consumers are thriving. And I love thinking about Airbnb versus the hotel business, because it looked at one point like Airbnb was just going to eat the hotel. It was going to be Uber and taxis all over again.
Yep.
And they were going to eat their lunch. And seeing the way that all of the brands have responded has really impressed me, because I think Hilton included, Hilton, Marriott, everybody stepped their game up to remind people what's so great about staying in
right.
a hotel.
Yep, yep,
and they
yep.
steered into that branding.
Yeah.
You know, don't worry about 1,000 rules when you check in or check out.
Yeah.
We are here to take care of you.
Yeah.
And reminding people of that has gone a long way. I'm interested to see where things go with hospitality, but I'm certain that the brands have sort of won the initial war, I think, against the short-term rental properties. And so, you know, I would just put sort of the hotel industry writ large as a big recent winner when it comes to branding, because I'm telling you, I was a believer that the industry was in trouble. And I no longer believe that at all. In fact, I think, you know, it's the short-term rental property industry that's gonna have to figure it out. And I'll tell you what, Vrbo, I don't want to call it bad advice, but there was this era of, oh, well, we'll just change this spelling. We'll just remove
the vowels. Yep.
Or, yeah, well, this is going to be an acronym, but then later we decide, well, we don't want it to be an acronym, so we're just going to come up with a way to pronounce it.
Yeah.
That is not the way,
yeah,
in my opinion. That being said, Vrbo has rolled through in the wake of, I think, Airbnb's sort of fall from grace with, I think, an increasingly compelling ad campaign about finding the sort of property you want to stay at through Vrbo, and a lot pitching more toward, like, I think, families traveling who want space and a kitchen and communal places. That's smart. That's thinking about, okay, well, who can our customers still be where the incentives align for a host to put their property on here and it not turn into this thing where there's, you know, cleaning fees and there's a rule book that's 20 pages long.
Take
you're supposed to familiarize yourself with.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The hospitality is really interesting. And I've been on a couple podcasts talking about this as well, but all of the new brands, a part of it was acquisition based. And so you bring two Marriott and a Starwood together, then all of a sudden you have all these extra brands. It cost a lot of money to rebrand and change a hotel from one brand to the next. So I'm sure a lot of that consolidation will happen as those licensing agreements go away. But the ones that seem like they have endured and grown the most are the single brand luxury properties, Aman, Rosewood, Auberge. And I think that'll always be the case because there's no confusion. There's no crossover. You're not worried about how do we appeal to the luxury customer as well as the budget conscious customer and everybody in between. They've kept it. Aman especially has kept it small footprint, very aspirational, and 100% focused on just one thing. That's got to be easier from a branding standpoint to, you know, your customer never really evolves. You don't want you don't want to have to come up with a new campaign to target somebody else. So those are the ones that I always look at as the tops.
And there's a reason for it too, which still comes down to ultimately, look, your branding, your trademarks, all of these things can be great. What's the product?
Yeah.
What's the service?
Yep.
Is it what the consumer expects it to be? And I actually think that hurt Hilton, Marriott, and some of those brands more than anything, because what's happened is I've stayed at some Hilton properties that are some of the nicest properties in the world. And they're just called the Singapore Hilton. I stayed at not too long ago. Was amazing. And then I stayed at a Hilton Times Square. And it offered nothing that I expect from a full service Hilton. There wasn't a nice fitness center. The room was tiny. There were very few amenities. There wasn't much food available. And I kept saying, why is this even a Hilton? I know now when I book a Hilton, and I love Hilton. I want to be clear. Like, I am a Hilton loyalist, but I never know. Sometimes I walk in, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is an amazing property. And sometimes I walk in, I'm like, okay, well, this feels like a budget hotel, and that's fine. I mean, I don't mind a budget hotel.
I want to, because that's interesting, because I think in all these different brands that they've come out with, they've lost what you've talked about a few times here, which is Hilton is a brand, Marriott is a brand. But when you said I stayed at the Singapore Hilton, in my mind, that was confusing because I forget that there is even a Hilton hotel.
That's right.
I just assume Hilton is sub-brand for, oh, okay, so was it a DoubleTree? Was it a Conrad? Was it a Waldorf? Was it something else? And so they've completely lost.
And that's my issue with the Hilton hotels themselves. Right. Because Hilton, to me, I often don't know what I'm getting. It might be closer to the Conrad.
Right.
It might be closer to the Hampton. Consumers want their expectations to be not just met, but exceeded. And when that happens, when you walk into a Hilton expecting something closer to a Conrad, and maybe you end up with a Hampton, even if you love Hamptons, I love Hamptons, you may find yourself disappointed. And ultimately, that's worse for brands. So I think your point about these smaller footprint places, these luxury properties that are thriving, it's for that reason, you know. People have an expectation, and then their expectation is either met or exceeded. And it's also easier for the brand. Like you said, I think about my firm. If you go to my firm's website, it's puppy dog themed. We say the puppy dogs are like gargoyles. They keep away the clients we don't want. Because if you come to my website and you see puppy dogs and you say to yourself, these lawyers aren't for me,
right.
They have puppy dogs on their website, you're probably actually not the client for us, because that's what branding actually is. Branding helps you find your ideal client. So these properties you're talking about, they're not trying to serve everyone. They're trying to serve their ideal client. I say that a lot of people get branding wrong. This is the way they look at things. There are people who like hot tea, and there are people who like iced tea, and then they serve everybody lukewarm tea. Because they're so scared of alienating people. But ultimately, what people want is to know what they're getting. And sometimes they're willing to pay for it if they feel like the experience makes it worth it. I think about clothing in this regard all the time. Like, these pants are from Lululemon. The truth is, I could probably go to Target and get almost the exact same pants for a fraction of the cost. In fact, they might even be made in the same factory these pants are made, right? In some ways, what you're paying for is either the experience when you go in the store, or that's why unboxing has become popular, right? The way it's boxed, the way it looks. I think people can always learn a lot from how they shop for things and interrogating, why do I want this more expensive thing? It's because of something about how it makes you feel. And that's why I say, your brand is your personality, and you really want to think about what is your personality and what do you want people to feel and think when they engage with your brand. And you benefit greatly if you commit to that and you don't try to necessarily cater to people who don't fit that. Now, if you realize, oh boy, our ideal customer base isn't actually big enough.
Right.
The market isn't big enough. Well, then, yeah, you are going to need to expand and figure out, okay, how do we bring in more people? How do we keep sort of our brand identity, not betray it, but welcome in new people? And tons of brands have had to deal with this. I mean, I think about Facebook. You know, Facebook launched when I was in college.
Yep.
I still remember your brother and I lived together at the time, and he got on pretty quickly and loved it and kept telling me, you've got to get on the Facebook. You've got to get on the Facebook. And I was like, the Facebook? What? No, I don't want to do that. Like that, I'm not, you know, I was being a little too cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, finally, I thought I held out for a long time. A few months later, I joined. At the time I joined, I think there were still only like 20 or 30 universities that even had access to Facebook, still then the Facebook. I remember all the controversies as they announced, we're going to open this up to non-college students, and the uproar, right? Now, that brand was obviously able to survive that backlash and has survived many other, you know, huge sort of existential threats, or so it seemed, but mostly in pursuit of larger market share, understanding, okay, we do have something, and it's actually not just for these people. We think we can make it for more people, and so let's figure out how we're going to do that, and then let's execute. Now, the execution is hard, and we've seen it, even with Facebook. You know, they've had their ups and downs in the execution of growing to where their potential customer base became basically every person on the planet, right? And when I talk to some of our startup clients who have big aspirations, of course, the talk is always ultimately, well, what is the actual market here? And is the market big enough for you to actually turn this little business into a big business?
We could be here for hours talking about this. It's one of my favorite topics in the world. I mean, we started out in football, ended up in tech, and it's universal, which is great. And I love it. We probably will need to do a whole hospitality one because we just scratched the surface.
I know
there.
That's what we really should do.
We should. We will. And we'll do it again soon. But we mentioned Trust Tree a couple of times, but tell everybody where they can find you guys and exactly what type of person needs to come to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So please come to our website, trusttree.com. We are an online legal services provider. Sometimes I say it's kind of like TurboTax for trademarks, except it's just real attorneys there to help you all the time. Our staff is only attorneys. We have no paralegals, no legal assistants. What we try to do is leverage technology to streamline the process so we can pass along savings to our clients. We don't bill by the hour. I'll talk to you for hours. Anyone who's listening to us talk probably can tell. I can talk. You want to talk? You want to strategize? We don't charge for things like that. We believe you shouldn't be nervous about talking to your lawyer about something because you don't know what sort of bill you might be getting in the mail. We are here to help you develop your strategy, build your business first. When it comes time to register trademarks, we'd love for you to work with us to do that. And we charge a flat fee. We provide flat fee trademark services. We also provide some patent services. So focus on intellectual property right now. We're hoping to expand maybe into some other areas soon, but we don't want to do that until we're ready. Just talking about the things we've talked about. When we think about growing, we're a trademark firm. That's what we know, and that's what we do. But if we meet the right people in the right space, we certainly would look to expand. So just to say, we try to practice what we preach. When we started this firm, that's why we chose a trademark rather than Pharrell Hartley and Michaels or what we may have otherwise named the law firm. We wanted to, again, practice what we preach. So please come to trusttree.com. If nothing else, you'll see the puppy dogs and maybe they'll make you smile, but it takes about 5 minutes to place an order. And it's, we think, a really easy process, and hopefully people will find that it is actually client friendly, because our goal is to make sure that the lawyer's incentives and the client incentives are aligned. And we think it's bad when the incentive is for the lawyer to have a case as complicated and take as long as possible versus when you charge a flat fee and then the lawyer's goal becomes, how can we do this as efficiently as possible, right? And that's what the client wants to. They want it efficient. We want it efficient. And so our whole firm is built around that central idea.
Yeah. It's been fun watching Trust Tree grow.
Well, we like to say we want people doing people things and computers doing computer things.
Yeah.
If the lawyer's doing something, they're doing a lawyer thing. They're not doing a thing their computer could otherwise be doing for them.
Yeah. It's a great service, and it really is as easy as you're saying it is. It's a great service. So everybody go check out trusttree.com. Give them a call. And Kev's not just saying that. He will talk to you for as long as you need. Really wide range of expertise and experience. So thank you for coming on. It's always good. We'll have you on again soon next time you're here, or virtually again, whatever, next time something big drops. But thank you guys again for tuning in to another episode of the Kronos Podcast. Again, we're sponsored by OPW Commercial Services. We'll see you next time.